everyone. It's Scott Tipps back again. It is Wednesday. It's December 19th, 2012. And I have here as my guest this week, we're very fortunate to have as our guest this week, Dr. John Cannell. And I met Dr. Cannell about 5 years ago, very briefly. He was speaking right after I spoke on Codex Alimentarius in the Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania area, and I think it was 2007. It could have been 2008, but in any event, it was several years ago. And I remember when I met you, Dr. Cannell. Welcome to the program, by the way.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you. You were so tall. I was wondering how you made it through the door, but in any event, you gave such a fascinating speech back then on vitamin D that it always stuck in my mind. And in fact, right now I have in front of me this great book that you wrote called Vitamin D, Athlete's Edge, Faster, Quicker, Stronger. Well, actually, I said it backwards, didn't I? Athlete's Edge, Faster, Quicker, Stronger with Vitamin D. And it's really a fascinating book. Of course, I'm very interested in health and nutrition anyway, but I think even for the ordinary person who may not be so interested in these subjects, and I only mean ordinary in the sense of interested in other things, not in, you know, general, but that they would find it a fascinating book. But let me just give the rest of my introduction here. I had to kind of do a sidestep there because I remembered meeting you that time. And let me tell the audience that Dr. John Cannell is an MD and got his degree from medical degree from the University of North Carolina. And about the time I was getting my degree or going into law school back in Berkeley. In any event, he is really quite an activist in the United States, and he's taken stands in the most recent past, last 10 plus really years, on the vitamin D deficiency epidemic. And anyone who lives above the 40th parallel, roughly, and John could correct me on this, but needs to be especially concerned about this epidemic, this vitamin D deficiency epidemic. But Dr. Cannell has a very eclectic past because not only has he been an MD and an American activist, but he's contributed to so many different debates, from public debate on black lung legislation to actually cleaning up schools in West Virginia, where they were the school officials were aghast at the fact that anyone would dare suggest that their public schools were not as clean as possible. And he effectuated some changes there. And also problems with educational testing that really made me kind of laugh when I read about it, not because it wasn't serious, but because of what Dr. Cannell found out. You know, a national average, when you take a national average on testing in the United States or any country for that matter, you would expect there'd be about equal numbers above and below the mean line of the scores there. But what Dr. Cannell found was everyone, even the poorest states, were testing above the national average. In fact, no one was below the national average. So what would that tell you? That would tell you there's something wrong with educational testing. And so in true activist style, Dr. Cannell set about shining light on that. But really the PET project, if I can call it that, that he's had lately has been as founder and promoter of the Vitamin D Council. And I want to recommend to each and every one of you who are out there to write down this web address, www.vitamindcouncil, and that's spelled C-O-U-N-C-I-L. It's not spelled like legal counsel, it's spelled like a city council. So vitamindcouncil.com, is that right?
No, vitamindcouncil.org.
Oh, I'm sorry, .org. And I'm glad you corrected me, .org. And if you need any ammunition when you're out there to support either your own view or someone else's view on the efficacy and the really necessity of taking vitamin D, you want to go to this website. This is where I go for my information. This is a very important, very science-based website, and not junk science, but real science. And so besides being the author of several books on different subjects, including vitamin D, he also is the author of two recent theories concerning vitamin D. The first is on vitamin D and the and influenza, and the second is on vitamin D and autism. And so without taking up more time, because we did get a little bit of a late start, John, I want to welcome you to the program again, and thank you for being on. Thank you for having been so gracious as to understand when I couldn't, when I had to cancel us and postpone our talk last time because of my mother's illness. But thank you so much for being here.
Oh, you're welcome, and thanks for having me.
Well, I am so keen on having you on because you're such a font of information on vitamin D, and I think ever since I saw you that time, I'd always taken vitamin D, but at the low levels, you know, 400 international units, thinking that was fine. But you really educated me, and since then I started taking a lot more. And so tonight, you know, we want to probably just cut to the chase, and you had teased us a little bit with the little known facts about vitamin D. Do you have anything to share with our listeners about that?
Yeah, the first thing I think that's important for people to realize is that vitamin D is not a vitamin. It's a steroid hormone system that has traditionally began in the skin. So, you know, most vitamins are cofactors in enzymatic reactions or antioxidants. So vitamin D, like all steroid hormones, goes directly to your genes and turns genes on and off. So it regulates the production of proteins and enzymes directly at the genomic level. And that's a very profound mechanism of action, and it makes it very different from every other vitamin and mineral and supplement. It's a steroid hormone like testosterone or estrogen or progesterone or estradiol. So it's very important to understand that. And it looks as if there are well more than 200 human genes that are directly regulated by vitamin D. That is, if you don't have enough vitamin D, those genes literally don't know what to do. They don't know whether to upregulate or downregulate the proteins that they make. The second thing that's important about vitamin D is that it was never made to be put in the mouth. It only has to be put in the mouth now because we avoid the sun. But when I was growing up, you know, there wasn't any sunscreen. I mean, there was baby oil and coconut oil and coconut butter when you went to the beach, but there was never any SPF 100 and 200. And now we have people, even people in Florida and San Diego and Arizona are vitamin D deficient because they avoid the sun like the plague because they're afraid of getting skin cancer. And so if you avoid the sun, you have to take a vitamin D supplement no matter what latitude you live at. And in fact, unless you sunbathe, you need to take a vitamin D supplement. So incidental sun exposure is not adequate. What we're talking about is 10 or 15 minutes at solar noon every day in your bathing suit to get enough vitamin D. And very few people can do that. And even like you point out, above the 35th parallel, there's what's called a vitamin D winter. That is, there's the UVB radiation that makes vitamin D in the skin comes in such an oblique angle that the ozone in the atmosphere deflects it. So there's a vitamin D winter in which no vitamin D can be made in the skin above the 35th parallel, and that winter is longer the further poleward you go. So those two facts, and then the third fact that I think it's really important is that the amount of vitamin D you make if you go to the beach in the summertime in your bathing suit is equivalent to about 100 to 200 glasses of milk. Huh. That is, if you go to the beach in the summertime, you'll make between a quarter and a half of a milligram of vitamin D, or 10 to 20,000 units of vitamin D from the sun, assuming you have your bathing suit on and assuming you're out at around solar noon. And recently there was a study from looking at hunter-gatherers in equatorial Africa who wear a few clothes and who are outside all day foraging for food. And those studies indicated that they were getting between 5,000 and 10,000 IU a day of vitamin D. And so that's about 10 times what the government recommends. So there's huge mistake has been made in the dosage of vitamin D supplements that need to be taken, and the amount in a glass of milk is basically insignificant except for a child, where it is significant. Yeah. So those three facts make vitamin D really quite different, quite unique from other vitamins and minerals.
Well, let me ask you something, because I've had some people, even in preparation for this program, ask, and then some have just kind of are questions I'm anticipating. The vitamin D, does it have any effect on like chronic fatigue syndrome? Would it help with chronic fatigue? Would that be indicative of a low vitamin D status, perhaps?
Yes. There's only open controlled studies now. There's no randomized controlled study of chronic fatigue, but certainly that's been my experience and the experience of other people, that these vague weakness and pain disorders that doctors cannot pin down, and are called fibromyalgia or chronic fatigue syndrome, and a number of others, are often simply osteomalacia. That is adult rickets. And oftentimes, when you get the vitamin D levels on these patients, they're 15 or 12 or 9 or 10 when they should be 50 nanograms per milliliter. And about half the time, people with these syndromes will respond dramatically to vitamin D supplementation.
Well, I was curious about that. So then if they're an adult, especially living, say, in Northern Europe, obviously far above the 35th parallel, and thanks for correcting me on that. I just sort of eyeballed a map that showed roughly about the 40th parallel, so I'm glad to see I was fairly close, but good to have it set straight on that. But anyway, an adult living above and well above the 35th parallel, probably around the 44th or so, how much vitamin D would this person take on?
If they're a lifeguard in the summertime, they don't need to take any at the 45th parallel. Even if they're a lifeguard in the summer, they need to take it in the winter because they can't make it in the winter. And most people work inside and they can't sunbathe every day. Even if you live in Florida, you need to take vitamin D unless you're sunbathing on a regular basis, because the human genome evolved in Africa, in equatorial Africa, East Africa, with people who were naked living, under the equatorial sun, scavenging for food all day long. So that's what the human genome evolved with, and that's what we think the human genome needs, is what it has traditionally. We call that a natural vitamin D level. And that's one thing that people should think about after they start supplementing. But adults need about 5,000 IU a day, and luckily now you can get 5,000 IU capsules in just about any drugstore, and you can order them on the internet, and it's just one tablet or one capsule a day. Then after you've been on it for 3 or 4 months, get a vitamin D blood test to make sure that it's adequate for you, because if you're obese, it probably will not be an adequate dosage. And the level that you should seek is about 50 nanograms per milliliter. The range in American labs is 30 to 100 nanograms per milliliter. So you want to be right in sort of in the middle of the range. Don't accept a level of 32 or 35. That's not adequate. It needs to be natural, which is about 50 nanograms per milliliter. And that takes about 5,000 IU a day for most adults, 10,000 IU a day for the obese.
And, is this something, are there any, leaving aside milk, there are people like me who don't drink milk, but are there any natural food sources that are naturally rich in this that you would suggest?
Yeah. Yes, there are reindeer meat and seagull eggs and lichen and cold water fatty fish such as salmon and sardines have significant amounts of vitamin D. Not the farm raised salmon, but the wild caught salmon have about 800 international units per serving. So if you want to get it from fish, you'd have to eat 6 or 7 servings of cold water fatty fish a day to get adequate amounts of vitamin D. But fish is one cold water fatty ocean fish is one source of natural vitamin D, really the only one of any significance.
Mm.
Except for children, where, again, children, the vitamin D fortified in milk and in a few orange juices is significant if you only weigh 20 pounds.
So how about whale blubber, since we're going into the exotic meats?
Right. Yeah, in fact, the whale blubber is rich in vitamin D. In fact, what's very interesting that there's never been a civilization that has survived the extremes of latitude unless they found a source of vitamin D in their diet, like the Inuit found with whale blubber.
Yeah, and then they could survive. Yeah, I read that somewhere. I'm sure it's in one of your books, actually, that mankind couldn't spread outside of the vitamin D zone until it found a way, either through dairy products or like whale blubber, to survive north or south of that zone.
Right. Right. And dairy products, grass-fed beef, for example, would have some vitamin D in it. But now, of course, as you know, beef are raised in basically factories where they're fed, you know, indoors in grain. And meat now has very little vitamin D in it. It used to have a significant amount of vitamin D in it, but it has almost no vitamin D in it now. And the same with milk, unless the milk is fortified with vitamin D. It has little milk in it, but
Mostly, that vitamin D is the synthetic form, and that's a more dangerous one to take, isn't it?
Well, it used to be that they used D2. Now they're using D3 more and more to supplement. So almost all the supplements you get and almost all the supplementing milk is now D3.
Oh, in milk. So what they add is D3, huh?
Okay. Yeah, they add D3 now. There was a time where they added D2, but that's gone.
Oh, well, you can tell how behind the times I am on milk drinking then. I think last time.
Yeah, a lot of people that don't drink dairy and you know, they have good reasons not to. And that's very concerning for children because other than dairy, other than vitamin D fortified milk, children, if they avoid the sun, and most children, of course, do, because you can get charged with child abuse if you let your child get sunburned. So parents are very careful to keep their kids out of the sun or to put sunblock on them, which blocks vitamin D production. So my big concern is the number of toddlers and 6-month-olds and 18-month-olds who have virtually no source of vitamin D in their skin or in their diet, and what's happening to them because of that. And what's happening is there are three epidemics that have occurred since the vitamin D deficiency epidemic has occurred. And these have all occurred among our children, and that's the epidemic of asthma, the epidemic of autoimmune disorders such as juvenile rheumatoid arthritis, juvenile lupus, juvenile multiple sclerosis, and the third epidemic is the epidemic of autism. And there's more and more scientists that think all three of these childhood epidemics are related to vitamin D.
Interesting. Well, then, what do you suggest for someone who has autistic children?
I recommend that they have their child's vitamin D level checked and only be satisfied when that child's level is in the high normal range. Again, the range is between 30 and 100 in American labs. So you want if you have a child with autism or asthma or an autoimmune disorder, you want to have high natural levels, which are about 80 nanograms per milliliter. And again, in the study, the Lux Wolda study from Tanzania that I referred to earlier among hunter-gatherers, their average range was 30 to 80 nanograms per milliliter, and some had as high as 105 nanograms per milliliter. So being in the high range of the normal range in the United States is where you want to be if you have a child with any of these afflictions, and you want to do that as soon as possible.
I see. And then there are different kinds of tests. Which particular vitamin D test do you recommend?
Yeah, there's only one useful vitamin D test, and that's the 25-hydroxy vitamin D. It used to be that doctors would order the wrong test. They'd order a 1,25 dihydroxy vitamin D, and that's a useless test to determine vitamin D sufficiency. The only test that can determine vitamin D sufficiency is a 25-hydroxy vitamin D, but most doctors who order tests now know that. And you can learn about that on our website. I appreciate that you putting in a plug for our nonprofit. The Vitamin D Council has been in existence now almost 10 years, and it's a nonprofit, tax-exempt organization, and we're desperately in need of contributions here at the end of the year. And we have been trying to educate people about vitamin D deficiency for the last 9 years. If you Google vitamin D, you'll see that we're the third spot after, I think, Wikipedia and the National Institutes of Medicine or something. But we have membership that's $5 a month, and you get access to all our blogs for that, and as well as the entire website. Although if you don't want to pay anything, we have an enormous amount of free information on our website too. But the most recent studies, one coming out every day, every week, are the ones that we blog about. So for $50 a year or $5 a month, you can become a member and support a worthwhile cause. I also appreciate you plugging my book. All the profits of that book go to the Vitamin D Council. And the book is called Athlete's Edge. It's not just for athletes, although there's some randomized controlled trials showing that vitamin D helps athletic performance, but it's for anybody who has muscles and nerves. If you have muscles and nerves, you should read this book, because the same process that allows vitamin D to improve athletic performance allows people with muscles and nerves to balance better, to have better muscle strength, to have better reaction times, etc. So vitamin D is very involved in the brain and the neural system and muscles, that's why it improves athletic performance in vitamin D deficient athletes. As you know, that's one of the reasons that there were so many world records set in the Mexico City Olympics in 1968, is because for the first time in a long time, the Olympics were held close to the equator at a very high altitude, and athletes had to come and get acclimatized to the altitude before they were performed. So the athletes were all vitamin D sufficient because they were training outside, and that's why they were, in my opinion, so many world records set in outdoor events during the 1968 Olympics, because there were so much vitamin D in the system. And the other thing that was interesting is that we found evidence, when I wrote the book, I found evidence that the Russians and East Germans had realized in the 50s that irradiating their elite athletes with ultraviolet B radiation improved athletic performance, and there's dozens of studies in the German and Russian literature about that. And the Germans and Russians started irradiating their elite athletes in the 50s, and that led to a 30-year domination of sports by the Russians and East Germans until they stopped doing the practice in the mid-80s. So.
Well, speaking of which, what do you think of these sunlight beds, the UV beds? And I'm sorry, I'm not as familiar with them because I don't use them. Perhaps I should, but I don't use the magnetic buzzing ones. But for those who use the healthier ones, are those a good thing? And how much time should they spend?
Yeah, the low pressure beds, not the high pressure beds, but not the new kind, but the old fashioned kind, and all the suntan parlors have the old fashioned kind. Basically, they're low pressure, old fashioned beds, and they replicate sunlight at the equator at about 5,000 feet of altitude. So I use them myself, and I recommend that people use them, but that you have to be very respectful of sunlight at 5,000 foot altitude at the equator, because it can burn you quite easily. So I always recommend people treat their vitamin D deficiency before they start using sunbeds. But the sunlight and the type of sunlight that's replicated in these old-fashioned beds is useful in the body for a number of ways, not just vitamin D. But there are a number of different mechanisms, melatonin, as well as bright light, as well as specific immune effects that sunlight has on the human body. And especially if you're in the northern part of the country, to go all winter without letting any UV radiation strike your skin strikes me as a dangerous thing to do, because it's so unnatural. Something that humans have not done until very recently.
I'm sorry, what is unnatural, to go without the sunlight?
It's to go without sunlight, right? It's to go without any radiation. So it's very unnatural.
If someone's taking, say, 6 minutes or 10 minutes a week of this low-pressure type bed, tanning bed, is that good? Or they need more?
Well, once their vitamin D level is up, and once they're used to it, they can go for more than six or eight minutes. I usually go for about 15 minutes or once a week in the wintertime.
I see.
And then in the summer, I try to get regular sunlight. Sunlight's always the best choice as long as it's in the summer or the late spring or the early fall. But in the winter and late fall and early spring, it's useless at most latitudes. And, of course, it's useless if you put on sunscreen as well.
Right.
And wear a lot of clothes like people do. So,
well, John, is there a particular brand of tanning bed you would recommend? One of our listeners is asking.
Sperti makes a UV, S-P-E-R-T-I, Sperti makes a number of UV apparatuses that are not expensive. If you want a full lay-down bed, I don't have any brands to recommend, but you just have to be careful that you get an old-fashioned low-pressure UV bed, not the high-pressure UVA beds. The high-pressure UVA beds do not replicate sunlight.
Okay.
They can, but they don't replicate sunlight.
I'm sorry to jump around on you here a bit, but we have a number of questions coming in from the chat line. One asks if you, Dr. Cannell, have a recommended amount for nursing mothers to take vitamin D so that the baby reaches sufficiency.
Yes, the mother should take 6,000 IU a day. 5,000 is probably enough for some people, but 6,000 units a day, 5,000 for the mother and 1,000 for the baby. So it's very interesting. When I was in medical school, one of the mysteries that I always thought about was, why is breast milk deficient in vitamin D? That is, how could the perfect food not have vitamin D in it, since vitamin D is so important for everything? And the answer is that it doesn't have vitamin D in it because the mothers are almost all deficient. That's how widespread vitamin D deficiency is. But if the mother sunbathes or takes 5,000 or 6,000 units a day, her breast milk will be a rich source of vitamin D, and the infant doesn't have to be supplemented at all. Although when the infant is weaned, then the infant needs to either go into sunlight or needs to start taking supplements. And the correct dose for children is approximately 1,000 IU for every 20 pounds of body weight.
I see. Well, then someone before it asked about high creatine kinase levels. Would that be tied in somehow with vitamin D levels if a child had high
most creatine kinase used to be called CPK, or creatine phosphokinase is originated from the muscle. And when the muscle has inadequate amounts of vitamin D, it makes elevated CPK, and so does the bone. And that's been a traditional indicator of subclinical rickets, actually. So if a child has elevated CPK, by far the most likely thing is he has subclinical rickets and is vitamin D deficient.
Okay. Well, thank you. That's important to know, because I think, you know, some of these doctors who would otherwise treat these young children, they're totally ignorant on this subject. And it sounds like you've had more than a share of encounters that way as well.
And we've been trying, you know, that's the mission of the Vitamin D Council. And for the last 9 years, we've been trying, and I think successfully beginning the process of educating doctors. I mean, when we first started 9 years ago, you know, doctors thought vitamin D is going to kill you. They ordered the wrong blood test. They thought that 400 units a day was adequate. And now things are starting to change, although doctors mistakenly still prescribe a medication called Drizdol or ergocalciferol vitamin D2, and that's not the way to treat vitamin D deficiency. They give 50,000 IU capsules every week, and that, if you're on that, don't take it. Go to the drugstore and get 5,000 IU of D3 cholecalciferol and take one of those every day. That's the way to treat vitamin D deficiency. Don't take vitamin D2 or Drizdol. It's not vitamin D.
Okay, thank you. That's important to know. And for those of you who just came on, again, we're talking with Dr. John Cannell. His website is www.vitamindcouncil.org. And it's a nonprofit, and they are the ones who, more than anyone else, I think, on the planet, are responsible for having good, solid scientific information out there on vitamin D and its benefits and its uses And they really need donations. So if you can make your way to that website, make a donation from anywhere in the world, you'll really be helping to keep them active and getting the latest information out. And it is not money that's wasted at all. So let me see who else. There's a question someone asked about using vitamin D3 as the first-line therapy for high blood pressure. Is that something that would help with high blood pressure?
Yes, it will help in some cases of high blood pressure. It depends on the etiology of the hypertension. If it's caused from what's called high renin hypertension, there's an enzyme made in the kidneys that can elevate blood pressure. Vitamin D directly down-regulates the renin gene, so it will help specifically in that. But a recent study have shown that vitamin D by itself at 5,000 units a day works as well as about the standard antihypertensive treatment, lowering blood pressure by about 8 to 10 millimeters of mercury diastolically and systolically. So it does work, but how well it works and whether you need to continue antihypertensive depends upon the specific cause of your hypertension. Much of the hypertension in this country is caused from potassium and magnesium deficiencies. It used to be thought that it was caused from sodium excesses, but it's really the ratio of potassium to sodium that's the problem. 97% of Americans have too much sodium, but 97% of them also have too little potassium. And it's very important. That's one of the reasons that you're supposed to eat 6, 7, 8 servings of vegetables a day, is to get adequate potassium and magnesium. And very few people can do that unless you're on a paleo diet. Do people get enough potassium and magnesium? And that's why they should take potassium and magnesium supplements. Most people should.
Well, some people are saying, too, that in taking vitamin D, you need vitamin K2 as well. What do you think about that?
Yeah, vitamin K2 is very interesting because it's made in the body from vitamin K1. It used to be thought it was made by the intestinal bacteria, but they have subsequently used a sterile animal model in which there was no biome, no gut flora in the sterile animal model, and they've demonstrated that vitamin K1 is turned into vitamin K2 by something in the body. It looks like it's the intestine, but it's not clear. The question is, how much does the body need? And the natural sources of vitamin K2 are very restricted. If you get out of fermented products like natto, the fermented Japanese, I think it's a seaweed product that's very high in K2, and hard cheeses and organ meats have K2 in them, but not at the dose that people are recommending. So I personally believe K2 is quite important, and I think you should get at least 80 micrograms a day of vitamin K2. And there's some supplements of vitamin D that have all the cofactors in them that you can get. Because besides vitamin D, vitamin D requires magnesium, zinc, boron, and vitamin K2 to work properly. So you can get, if you don't take a supplement that has all that in it, you should get magnesium, zinc, boron, and vitamin K2 individually, because vitamin K2 directs calcium to its proper object, that is the bone, and directs it away from improper objects such as arteriosclerotic plaques in the heart. And it does a lot more than blood coagulation, which is a function of K1, but vitamin K2 is involved in bone. It's involved in arteriosclerotic cardiovascular disease, atherosclerosis, and it appears that it may also be involved in neoplasia, but that's preliminary evidence.
Well, it's funny because I just got back from a Codex Alimentarius meeting in Germany, and they just fixed the nutrient reference value, the recommended daily allowance, at 60 micrograms a day, which I argued at the meeting was too little, and you just supplied me with some support there, for which I thank you. And so
there's a book out about K2 that's pretty good, and there's several books out, but The question is, where, if K2 is that important, where have humans traditionally gotten, very high amounts of K2? And I can see where they could get 100 to 200 micrograms a day from a diet, a paleo type of diet, but without fermented products, sauerkraut, or more importantly, not NATO, I think it's pronounced N-A-T-T-O,
yeah.
It's difficult to get K2 in your diet. It's difficult to eat enough fermented cheese products or enough organ meat to get that amount of K2. So we think 80 micrograms a day of K2 is adequate, but it may be that a little more than that is needed. And remember, your body will convert some of the K1 you get from fruit and vegetables will convert it into K2 as well. So.
Okay. Well, that's comforting to know, because I just recently started adding K2 to my diet. I get a brand from Carlson Labs that's maybe it's too much, maybe not, but it seems to work for me, and it's 5 milligrams. But the 80 micrograms is what I've seen with that kind of K2 that is, the variant form, and they say that's
right.
Adequate for that particular form. I think it's MK.
They've given as much as, for the Japanese have given as much as 45 milligrams, which would be totally impossible to get from diet in terms of treating osteoporosis. So there's very little danger of any overdose of K2, but it's an expensive supplement, and so the question is, how much do you actually need? So,
yeah. Well, in your research, Dr. Cannell, on the vitamin D3, have you found any difference between the soft gel capsules and the liquid that is just in eyedroppers or however it's dispensed?
No, the liquid, the D drops, is a very good brand of vitamin D. I know the people behind that. He's a professor and is a vitamin D expert, and so that for children in particular, D drops, one word, D drops, is a really good source. You can get the 1,000 IU drops, and a nursing mother, for example, if she doesn't want to take adequate doses of vitamin D herself, she can put a drop on her nipple, and the baby can get the vitamin D that the baby needs every day that way. For older children, they make a 2,000 IU per drop, so for a 25 or 35, 40-pound child, 2,000 IUs per day is what's needed. So remember, 1,000 units for every 20 pounds of body weight for children. So those drops are good. The dropper full is more of a problem because people mistakenly give a whole dropper full instead of drops, but the D drops you can't do that with. In terms of the other supplements, whether it be tablets or capsules, as long as it's taken with the biggest meal of the day, virtually any brand is adequate. They recently done some studies. ConsumerLabs.com has looked at the vitamin D content of various brands on the market, and they were all as advertised. So the big thing is to take it with food, take it with the fattiest meal of the day, which is usually the largest meal you have. So take it with supper, so it's absorbed better because it's a fat-soluble vitamin.
And then you should avoid taking it at the same time as vitamin A or not?
Well, we don't believe that anybody should be taking vitamin A for two reasons. If you eat any fruit and vegetables, you get vitamin A. And secondly, vitamin A is supplemented in so many foods. In the dairy products and breakfast cereals, et cetera, and it's supplemented in a extremely potent form called preformed retinol, that is retinol acetate or retinol palmitate, and that bypasses the body's regulatory system for vitamin A in the blood. And directs preformed retinol, dumps it directly into the systemic circulation without allowing the intestine to decide. Usually the way vitamin A is made is you eat a beta carotene or a carotenoid in a vegetable or fruit, and the intestine then senses the amount of serum retinol that's in the system, and if it needs more retinol, then it will convert beta carotene or carotenoids into preformed retinol. But if your body has enough retinol, it will not. And a recent study showed that 51% of Americans have excess retinol esters in their blood, and that 29% of Americans are vitamin A toxic.
Really?
Yes. 29%. So do not take vitamin A. Just don't take it. Especially don't take preform retinol. It'll say retinol acetate or retinol palmitate. Don't take any form of that. What it does is it interferes with the mechanism of action of vitamin D. Instead of vitamin D and a vitamin A molecule binding together to stimulate the gene, what happens is two vitamin A molecules bind together to weakly stimulate the gene and block the actions of vitamin D. It's a classic weak agonist type of situation when you have too much vitamin A. If you take vitamin A, you will not get the full effects of vitamin D. Mm-hmm. So people don't need vitamin A. They just don't need it. That's not true in developing countries. If you live in a developing country where you have a single carbohydrate source of nutrition and you eat very few green vegetables and fruit, and there's a lot of people in the world that do that, eat rice or sorghum or some wheat product, and that's what they eat and that's what they live on, those people are vitamin A deficient. So there's a big dichotomy in the world literature on vitamin A. You have to look at whether it's coming from a developed country or whether it's coming from a developing country to know how to interpret the literature.
Because otherwise, if you eat it naturally, one of our listeners is asking, you would find vitamin A in what, like fish, deep water fish?
Yes, well, again, the body makes vitamin A from vegetables and fruit. Any colorful fruit and vegetable, especially the yellow orange fruit and vegetables, are very high in the carotenoids and beta carotene, like a carrot. I mean, one carrot a day gives you more than enough vitamin A, way more than you actually need, but the body will only absorb the amount that's needed to take care of it. But there's very few natural sources of a preformed retinol, the one exception being cod liver oil, which is not a natural food. Cod liver oil was never consumed by Paleolithic man. It was never consumed when the genome was evolving. It's a processed food that was discovered a couple hundred years ago, and it has dangerously high amounts of vitamin A. And in fact, one of the papers that I've written in the last several years was a warning about cod liver oil, and it was written by 17. I was a lead author, but there were 17 nutrition experts, including Walter Willett at Harvard University, who is probably the best-known single best-known nutritionist in the world, Professor Walter Willett. And we all said the same thing, and that included 8 vitamin A experts on the paper, all warning against the consumption of cod liver oil. I remember when I love the Weston Price Foundation because they do such good work, but I remember I spoke with them once and warned them about cod liver oil, and the vitamin A expert they had come in warned them about vitamin A excess, but they're in love with with cod liver oil at the Weston Price Foundation. I think their main contribution, as far as I'm concerned, is the depletion of nutrients from the soil. They make such a good case for that, and it used to be the magnesium. Used to be the magnesium and potassium you could get it from eating lots of fruits and vegetables, but it is becoming increasingly difficult because of the depletion of soil. And that's just two examples. They have a lot more examples, but.
Yeah, they've done some good work there, and I like some of their approaches. But you're right, on some issues, they aren't quite all there, but still a lot.
It's always important to ask yourself, what is the natural source of this vitamin or mineral, and how much did Paleolithic man get? How much do we get when we were evolving in the genome? That's an important question to ask about all supplements and vitamins.
Well, let me ask you a tough question about vitamin D, if I may, Dr. Cannell.
Sure.
So how many people have died from taking natural vitamin D?
The last documented case we can find is in the 40s. And what happened is in the 1930s, after vitamin D was discovered, a number of doctors started recommending mega doses of vitamin D. I'm talking 100, 200, 500,000 units a day of vitamin D.
Yeah.
And they at first found these dramatic improvements in asthma and arthritis and stuff, but then by the mid-1930s and by the later 1930s, the deaths started to occur. And you can certainly kill yourself if you take, 100,000 units of vitamin D a day. But the last death that we can find was in the 40s, of people, again, taking these mega doses of vitamin D. So, 100,000, 200,000, 300,000 units a day can kill you. 5,000, 10,000 units a day is what you get naturally from the sun were you to be in a natural state.
And again, we're talking about D3 or D2 or
right.
both?
D3. D3 is what's made in the skin. Yeah. D2 is not human vitamin D. D2 is a patent medicine whose patent has expired. It's a D2. D2 is a vitamin D analog or a look-alike molecule, but it's not what's made in the skin. D3 is made in the skin. And D3 is what you get in the supplements.
You know, one thing that stood out in my mind about your talk was I remember you were saying how you keep in your desk drawer where you work, particular high-potency vitamin D, 50,000 international units, and it's sort of a break glass and open in an emergency sort of thing.
Right.
But
right.
That you don't take more than that. You just keep one, not to be tempted to take more, because when you take it, it lights up your brain like a floodlight, and
you're
like super genius or something. Did I misremember that? Is that true?
Yeah. It's more subtle than that, and 50,000 units a day is probably what's called the no observed adverse effects level, or the effect where nobody has documented toxicity from that dose. When you get above 50,000 units a day, and there's evidence that if you get a severe sunburn, you make about 50,000 units of vitamin D a day in your skin, but nobody needs that amount. But the only exception is people who are very vitamin D deficient, who are acutely ill, and you need to get their vitamin D levels up quickly. So somebody this time of year, for example, who's vitamin D deficient, who gets influenza or who gets heart disease or who gets a stroke or who gets some sort of acute medical illness that puts them in the ICU, those people should be given 50,000 units a day until their vitamin D level gets up above 50 nanograms per milliliter. So the other thing you'll notice is if you have a project that you want to do and you take 50,000 units a day for a couple of days, you'll notice that there's an improvement in your associative skills in your brain, the sort of like the connections between your left and right hemisphere are better, but that's not been documented in any randomized controlled trials, but it's certainly something that I've noticed. So it's kind of can be addicting that way because you also feel better. So it's taking 50,000 units a day is flirting with trouble, however, because the dose is excessive.
And also it's a great thing to give to the elderly, isn't it? Vitamin D.
Yes, it is. The elderly, fall and break their hips, and people have always been concerned about their bones. But what was beginning to be realized is why do they fall in the first place? And they fall in the first place because their balance and their reaction times are impaired by vitamin D deficiency. And that's what I address in my book, The Athlete's Edge, is exactly that kind of stuff. And so if you want to buy my book, just Google Athlete's Edge and my last name, C-A-N-N-E-L-L. That's C-A-N-N-E-L-L. And you can find the book. And again, all the profits from that book go to the Vitamin D Council. But it's really written for anyone who's interested in muscles and reaction time and nerves and the brain and vitamin D. And it's a tragedy how many elderly Americans are vitamin D deficient and how many of them will fall this year and break their hip and how fatal that prognosis is once fall and break their hip, how likely you are to die. So,
and it probably doesn't help that they are taking all these drugs either, I would think, but the vitamin D deficiency is probably key. But at least they aren't going out and shooting up schools on these drugs, so I guess we're thankful for minor miracles.
Yeah.
But we're coming near the end of the hour. Let me just say, I have Dr. Connell, John Connell's book in my hand, Athlete's Edge, and this is a really good book. I mean, it's easy to read, it's highly informative, and I do recommend that you get it. It's not overwhelming at all, and it'll give you all the facts on vitamin D probably that you need, because like Dr. Connell said earlier in the program, it's not just about being faster, stronger, quicker. It's also about operating at your highest maximum level because you're vitamin D sufficient instead of vitamin D deficient. So I want to thank you, Dr. Knell. We've got to leave because someone else has a program coming up after us. Otherwise, quite honestly, I could go on for another hour. You might not be able to, but
I could go on for another 10 hours. So anytime you want to repeat this, just let me know and I'd be glad to. Well, I appreciate you having me on.
Oh, it's my pleasure. And again, for those out there, go to the website, www.vitamindcouncil.org, and make a donation. Use the information as well, but, you know, you've got to pay for what you get. And so a donation would be out of the order either. We've been very fortunate to have Dr. John Knell with us. I would love to have you on again. Dr. Knell, it's so incredibly interesting, and it's always this way when I hear you talk or when you do, when you write, whatever, but thank you so much. And
Thanks, Scott. Thanks for having me. I appreciate it, and I enjoyed it.
Okay. Talk to you next time, and everyone stay tuned. Okay. Thank you. Everyone stay tuned for Sean McGuire, who's going to be up talking about some interesting stuff he's discovered. And I think he's getting the Queen of England to run for the presidency. I don't know. But anyway, stay tuned. And we'll see you next week. So do be there, 8 o'clock Irish English time, next Wednesday, Boxing Day. And be there or be square. Okay. Bye, everyone.